The headlines this hour. Russia says its military operation against Ukraine aims to prevent Kiev from joining NATO, stressing that it will press on with the operation until the end. The UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says that there are disturbing indications of discrimination against African and Asian nationals who want to flee the war in Ukraine. And Russia and Ukraine begin their second round of talks at the Belarus-Poland border. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Russia says its military operation in Ukraine is going according to plans and that nothing will stop Moscow from achieving its objectives. President Vladimir Putin made the remarks in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron. Putin said that Moscow wants to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine in order to make sure that Kiev won't pose a threat to Russia. Putin warned Ukraine against dragging out negotiations, saying that the Kremlin's demands will only increase if the talks are stalled. The president dismissed reports of Russia bombing civilians as disinformation. Earlier, Russia's top diplomat said some foreign leaders are preparing for war against Russia.
We won't let some provocations make us lose our balance. But those who plan to start a full-scale war against us should think. And I think that these plans are being plotted now.
Sergey Lavrov says Western politicians, unlike Russia, are contemplating the prospect of nuclear war. The top Russian diplomat accused NATO of seeking to maintain supremacy over his country. He urged the West to show Moscow mutual respect, emphasizing that Russia won't let anyone undermine its interests. In Ukraine, Lavrov stressed that Russia will not tolerate a military threat. He said that his country will not allow Ukraine to keep infrastructure that endangers the security of Russians, and that the ongoing military operation is aimed at stopping Kiev from joining NATO. The Russian foreign minister also accused Ukraine's president of ruling in an atmosphere where Nazism is flourishing. Moscow's military operation in Ukraine is in its eighth day, with Russian forces further advancing in the country. The mayor of Kherson has confirmed that Russian troops are now in control of the strategic port city. This is the first significant urban center to fall since Moscow launched its attack. Kherson is strategically important because it links Crimea in the south to Donbass in the east. Russian forces have also struck a radio and television center in Kiev and have captured the town of Balaklia near the capital. Heavy clashes are also underway in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. According to emergency workers, 34 civilians have been killed there in the past 24 hours. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe says that a Ukrainian member of its team was also killed in Kharkiv bombing. Moscow says its troops have encircled Mariupol on the Azov Sea coast. In the meantime, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has hailed his people's resilience and resistance.
The morale of the enemy is deteriorating. More and more occupiers are fleeing back to Russia. I sincerely admire the heroic resistance of our people and those that do not allow the occupiers to pass through, blocking everything for them, blocking roads. People come out in front of enemy vehicles. This is extremely dangerous, but how courageous.
Zelensky says the fence lines are holding against the Russian attack and that Ukraine is receiving daily arms supplies from its international allies. The fighting began last Thursday after the Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized a special military operation in Ukraine. Russia's defense ministry says that it has hit over 1,600 Ukrainian military sites since February the 24th. The ministry says that it has lost around 500 of its own troops in the fighting. Russia has also put the fatalities among Ukrainian soldiers and those whom it calls nationalists at close to 3,000. So far, there has been no confirmation from Ukraine. The UN Human Rights Chief expresses concern about, quote, disturbing indications of discrimination against African and Asian nationals who are fleeing the conflict in Ukraine. Addressing the UN's Human Rights Council, Michelle Bachelet urged Ukraine's neighboring countries to ensure that there is no discrimination against African and Asian nationals fleeing the war. She said all those fleeing the conflict must be welcomed by other countries, regardless of their citizenship or ethnicity. Bachelet made the call following reports that immigrants and students of color fleeing the conflict are stranded at the borders. In Poland, groups of people have reportedly attacked and abused African and Asian people who had crossed the border. Elsewhere in her remarks, Bachelet said that over 1 million people have so far been forced to flee Ukraine. She says the figure could rise to 4 million if the conflict continues. Russia's military operation in Ukraine continues to rattle global markets, with oil prices surging to their highest since May 2012. Brent crude oil has surged past $119 per barrel amid supply disruption fears amid the West's economic sanctions on Moscow. Gas rates rose as well, with average UK petrol prices hitting a new record. Observers are warning of costly energy bills if oil prices continue to rise. The hike comes as demand for Russian commodities is falling amid Moscow's continued military campaign in Ukraine. Russian oil and gas exports are exempted from Western sanctions for now, but the prospect of further action by the U.S. and Europe is stifling Russian trade. Reports say inflation in the Eurozone witnessed a new record high last month, mainly due to surging energy prices on the continent. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Delegations from Kiev and Moscow have kicked off a second round of peace talks as Russian forces make inroads in the south of Ukraine. The two sides are likely to discuss the possibility of a ceasefire and the establishment of a humanitarian corridor. The Russian delegation is led by presidential aide Vladimir Medinsky. He says that Moscow is ready to speak with the Ukrainian side for as long as it may take to reach an agreement. Russia and Ukraine concluded their first round of negotiations in Belarus on Monday, with no clear breakthrough. Jan Oberg, founder of Transnational.live, joins us from Lund. We also have Tony Gosselin, who's an historian and journalist, who joins us from Bristol. Welcome to you both. Jan Oberg, when we take a look at the situation in Ukraine, it is hard to decipher the strategy that Russia has in terms of what it is saying that it's doing versus what the West is saying that it's doing. Because we're having Russia say it's denazifying and demilitarizing Ukraine. It sees that as a threat, obviously. Where is the disconnect here? Or is there one that the West does not want the world to know?
It's very, very difficult. And I think the disconnect has been going on to a certain extent psychologically the last 30 years. This is not something that comes out of the blue. Of course, Putin's choice of reaction was a surprise to most of us. I myself had not thought he would do such a counterproductive, if not stupid, thing. I don't know what motivated it. But that there would come a reaction to 30 years of NATO expansion against all promises given to Gorbachev in 89-90 by all important Western leaders, which also made Gorbachev accept the unification of Germany, is not a surprise. The Western world is very good to talk about how it has a right to security and how it has red lines that should not be transgressed. Now, Putin has been trying for years, I think the first time really in 2007 at the speech in Munich, to say, you have to stop this expansion because I consider it, we in Russia consider it a potential threat to us. No matter what your intentions are, your capabilities are increasing to destroy Russia. I don't think that anybody took him serious. I don't think anybody listened. I don't think anybody since the end of the Cold War thought of what the Palmer Commission, for instance, talked about, common security, security zones, etc. And we have no statesmen in the Western world anymore. We have people who are running on one-dimensional thought, hubris, and we don't have to listen because we won the Cold War. Mm-hmm. But at the time, and I'm old enough to remember that, we had people like Willy Brandt and Bruno Kreisky and Oro Kekkonen and others, and Olof Palme, as I mentioned, who understood that you cannot have security against each other, but only with each other.
Okay. Let's go along those lines and ask you, Tony Gosselin. The Russian Foreign Intelligence Chief has come out and said this is no longer a Cold War, but it's a hot war for us. How do you see it, Tony Gosselin?
Well, I noticed one of my old colleagues on RT, Mark Sloboda, he is a U.S. analyst based in Moscow, at Moscow, one of the big Moscow universities, and he's calling it the Great Decoupling. I would totally agree. What's happened here is, and your initial question is about, you know, the difference between the Russian version of events and the Western version of events. Well, what we've seen really is two completely different narratives coming out through the media, the mass media, in depending on which side of the divide you are. And the most significant fact for me as a journalist watching this is to see the lights going out around the West of the RT channel. So basically, when people switch it on, there's just a blank screen. This has already begun to happen on most of our major television platforms. And this is, you know, this is extremely dangerous. And if you look at what happened back in the Second World War in the 1930s and the 40s, you know, this the British were confident enough in the righteousness of their cause against Nazi Germany. Obviously, there were many other countries in the United States and other European countries involved in that, not least of which is the Poles. We were confident enough to make sure that the Nazi propaganda coming out of Radio Luxembourg in English, broadcast to the whole of Britain, was not interrupted. So we had the belief that truth and justice and righteousness was on our side. What bothers me is by shutting down RT, what's happening is there is basically a disconnect going on in the Western elites, saying we're not interested in, we do not believe, we are actually afraid of the analysis that's coming from Russia. And obviously, as journalists, we want to see, hear, and present both sides, as I try to do on my regular podcast every Friday, you know, both sides of the discussion, mm-hmm. both sides of the argument. And as soon as you start to lose that, I believe you're beginning to lose the war. And by cutting off the balanced analysis and the ability to actually hear what the opposition is saying, you are setting yourself down on the route towards a much bigger war. And that's what bothers me most about this, is there's very little going back once you've decided that you're going to demonize the enemy and you're not going to listen to any of their quite reasonable concerns. And Putin was absolutely clear in his speech last Thursday morning that they see the increasing militarization of Ukraine as an existential threat to Russia as a state. So he believes it's life and death for the Russian state. And of course, they have to do something about that. Whether this is the right response is another question.
Okay, Jan Oberg, Russia has said that they're not interested in having a government there that they are going to control. The West doesn't seem to think so. They have said that time and again. When you take a look at the way that Russia wants to proceed from the time that they, you know, if they take control of their military objectives or obtain their military objectives, do you think that then the government there is going to be a government that is going to be independent? Because we know back in 2014, that was a democratically elected government until you had obviously foreign interference there in which the U.S. was part of.
And you might formulate it this way. Putin, in that case of your scenario, would do tit for tat or what was done in the by the West basically in 2014 when there was a regime change financed and orchestrated by American diplomats in Kiev. Mm. I think there's something else that should be said here, and that goes along with what Tony Gosling said. I feel increasingly, I have felt the last 20 years, this is nothing new, that the West is so weak, morally and intellectually, not militarily, that it cannot accept diversity in our media, that it cannot accept more narratives coexisting and talking with each other. This began to a certain extent during the Yugoslav wars 25 years ago. I experienced it very strongly myself when I had been to Syria. It was not possible to publish one article or one of my photos in the Western mainstream press. So there's nothing new in that. And it has also to do with the fact of what I call security intellectual disarmament, the only disarmament we have had. And that is people don't read books anymore. Ministers do not know the basics of deterrence theory. People do not know anything about security, common security. It's not an intellectual process before decisions are made in ministries of foreign affairs. They spend the money not on expertise, but on marketing and you know, selling arguments, and most politicians know, and I say this with 45 years of experience in this field, know too little at the same time as they are handling questions about the humanity's survival. That okay. makes me be frightened way above or beyond what Putin sure. is doing or the West is doing. And I think that is something that has paved the way for the one-dimensional thinking. We are at the level intellectually now where this, what we're talking about here, Ukraine, is no longer considered a conflict with two parties. It's right. considered one party who is innocent and who is harassed by Russia as the evil party that must now be punished. And my final word on that is the reaction to the invasion, the uniformity of the reaction in the West is to me more worrying than the invasion in its long-term consequences. I think what the West is now trying, will do the next few years, is to suffocate economically, politically, and otherwise uh-huh. Russia and get a regime change like in Kiev in 2014 in Russia.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we just fresh out of time, but thank you for that. Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, Jan Oberg, a pleasure, founder of transnational.live from Lund. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
A new statistical report on the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza shows the unbearable price paid by Palestinians for the maintenance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Maureen Claire Murphy Ryder. This article is published under the heading Gaza Pays the Price for Jewish State in Palestine. This is the second part of this article. But so long as Palestinians rightly refuse to submit to the removal and replacement with foreign settlers, the Zionist regime as the colonizing power requires a horrendously violent policy like the Zahir Doctrine. That was admitted by the Haifa University demographer Aaron Sofer, a close advisor to the late Israeli regime Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, ahead of the latter's unilateral withdrawal of settlers from Gaza in 2005 and tightened blockade on the territory 2 years later. Sofer anticipated that Palestinians in Gaza, isolated and closed off and with little other means of leveraging pressure on the Zionist regime, would rely on firing projectiles to resist what has become a medieval siege. We will tell the Palestinians that if a single missile is fired over the fence, we will fire 10 in response, and women and children will be killed and houses will be destroyed, Sofer explained. Anticipating the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, Sofer added, the pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So, if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill. All day, every day. This violence is necessary to guarantee a Jewish Zionist regime with an overwhelming majority of Jews, as Sofer thought. That is the logic underlining the Zionist regime's violence last May, when War Minister Benny Gantz warned that no person, area, or neighborhood in Gaza is immune. And so, 14 families lost 3 or more members when the Zionist regime bombed their homes. Half of all fatalities during the May war occurred in Gaza City, where the Zionist regime targeted densely populated neighborhoods and wiped out multiple generations of individual families. In addition to those killed, nearly 2,000 people in Gaza were wounded, among them 941 men, 630 children, and 397 women. Meanwhile, more than 1,300 residential units were destroyed and 6,367 sustained significant damage, mainly in northern Gaza and in the Gaza City area. Some 420 hectares of agricultural land was damaged by the Zionist regime's missiles and artillery shells, or because of obstruction to access affecting more than 5,350 people. Additionally, more than 220 livestock and poultry farms were damaged, as were 24 water wells, 169 vehicles, 59 manufacturing plants, 483 commercial facilities, and 871 other facilities, including banks, daycare centers, private offices, schools, houses of worship, and government offices. The rights groups that authored the statistical report point to the Zionist regime's broader policy of harm adopted at the highest levels. In particular, the widespread targeting of family homes in Gaza has appeared as a key feature of the Zionist regime's military attacks, they add. This conduct forms part of the Zionist regime's institutionalized system of racial discrimination and intent to dominate and oppress the Palestinian people as a whole, a policy that amounts to the crime of apartheid. Amnesty International recently joined the Palestinian human rights groups calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate the commission of the crime of apartheid. In Gaza, the Zionist regime subjects Palestinians to a blanket ban on movement as part of its intent to separate and divide Palestinians and thereby to assert its domination over them in furtherance of its overarching settler colonialist agenda, according to Al-Mizan. The tightened blockade since 2007, along with repeated Zionist regime's military assaults, have forced Gaza into profound levels of poverty, aid dependency, food insecurity, and unemployment, and led to the collapse of essential public services, including healthcare and water, sanitation and hygiene, Al-Mizan adds. Indeed, according to the human rights group, the Zionist regime's actions have rendered Gaza all but uninhabitable. The Zionist regime has killed more than 5,200 Palestinians, including some 1,200 children, during four full-scale military offensives in Gaza since 2008. The worsening water crisis in the territory is meanwhile tied to the Zionist regime's demographic engineering in Palestine. As Al-Mizan notes, Gaza is one of the most densely populated areas in the world, with two-thirds of its people, refugees, denied the right to return to their lands on the other side of the Gaza-occupied territory's boundary fence. The Zionist regime's targeting of Palestinian homes in Gaza, killing their inhabitants, creates a coercive environment in which families have no choice but to move, Al-Mizan adds. This has caused the forced internal displacement of tens of thousands of Palestinian families, a number of whom remain without safe, adequate, and/or affordable permanent housing today. The Zionist regime officials have admitted that the regime is encouraging emigration from Gaza, facing some of the highest unemployment rates in the world and few prospects young people with the means of leaving Gaza are doing so. Al-Mizan observes, the aim has been to create and maintain an Israeli-Jewish superiority, consolidating effective control and dominance with the aim of gradually eradicating the indigenous Palestinian people. One missile, one bullet, and one destroyed future at a time. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kip Anderson and Keegan Kuhn. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere, it abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
We're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
And one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact. Trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. You know, everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns and have to pull out.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. I mean, this documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so. And everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat-eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
And he's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Like you said about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. Mm-hmm. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous bit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already and the, you know, mm-hmm. activists against fossil fuels and things like this mm-hmm. as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the mm-hmm. agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on as we show the clips in regard to that part of the programme. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but it does break it down in quite very obvious terms. He uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out this situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforests for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's fresh water, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kip Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. Mm-hmm. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak up and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on, but I mean, when he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing, which they talk about. Mm. Every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
Mm-hmm. It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, yeah. Which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely, and if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction, it's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant, because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and the inhumane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing. And it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not the term vegan is another matter. Mm-hmm. But they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on the people in positions of power rather than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
Couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, as they say, you know, use less coal, ride your bike. What about, you know, less meat?
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it and it's a political loser. In terms of, yeah, because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I had invited to a meeting with Al Gore and some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushed back. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in An Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head round, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message and he keeps telling you this. And he keeps showing you, talking to all these different organisations. You know, I understand lobbyists. That's I would expect that from them and to a certain extent from the government. But from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the VT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another,
interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money, have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes.
Well,
so either
way,
they plead ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost again speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been he would have lost.
Yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly. Or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time. Maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
Well, exactly.
A massive, massive farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing actually. They have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now.
The animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics, and we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is polluting the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they are monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learn from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject, you know.
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatising it, perhaps?
It's hard to say. The fact that their funding was removed, and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists, isn't a surprise as such. But, I don't know. Verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, if we hear that, according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, yeah. I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider, I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the program. I mean, he's been criticized for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
And Mary, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.